Let me in. Shiba, shiba. I want to be closer to you. Shiba, shiba. Open up your soul. Shiba, shiba. Let me find that part of you. The part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something. Y'all have heard this show many times and you know what a fan I am of silent film. And every year there's a silent film festival, and every year I am delighted to have Anita Monga here to talk about it. So I'm going to allow my delight to spread across the airways by welcoming Anita Monga. Hello.
Hi, Marilyn.
How's it going?
Okay, it's kind of crazy right now.
So, Anita, before for our listening audience who may be new, how did you get started with the Silent Film Festival?
Stacy Wisniak asked me. I had been a longtime programmer at the Castro Theater, mm-hmm. and she was the manager of the Castro, and she became the executive director of the Silent Film Festival, and she asked me to come on board when their programmer left.
And it was that simple. And did you ever think that you would be doing it as long as you have?
No. No, I was like I was an emergency fill-in. Mm. But the festival is enchanting. I always knew that as an audience member. And so it pulled me in.
Got it. So do you recall what the theme of your first festival was?
You know, we never have a theme. Oh. Our theme is, our motto is True Art Transcends Time. And what we try to do is just pick the best films, the most interesting films in a balanced program and put that across. But we don't have necessarily themes, although we always find themes that come out in the festival. Mm-hmm. For instance, one year we had like several films where children were thrown out of windows. That became our theme for that year.
Okay.
This year, actually, we have like there are two films about the Klondike, mm-hmm. the Gold Rush and the Trail of 98. Mm-hmm. And we have two films that also have song in their title. So I guess those are unintentional themes.
Okay, well, let's talk about this year's festival. Now, in the past, it had been at the Castro, but that hasn't been an option for a while. So where is it this year?
So we found the most lovely theater in Orinda, California. And for those of you who might like be fearful of going so far afield, Orinda is so easy to get to. It is like a 30-minute BART ride from Civic Center BART. Uh-huh. And it is, so the BART station here is a 4-minute walk to the theater. So it's just delightful. It's a little town just east of Oakland. So it's about 3 minutes from Rock Ridge BART station. Uh-huh. And it has, and if you insist on driving, there is parking. And it's lovely out here. It's like I'm calling it our summer camp in November.
Okay, you're talking my language because I'm all about the public transportation where you can easily walk. So for those of us who will be on public transportation, say it again. Where do you get off?
You get off at the Orinda BART station.
Simple.
And then there's just a 4-minute walk, clearly marked, to the theater. Ah. And the theater is in a little village that has restaurants and lots of restaurants, lots of cafes, lots of walking. Mm-hmm. So it's lovely.
Okay. Okay. And what's the name of the theater?
The Orinda Theater.
Oh, simple, simple, simple. Love it, love it, love it. Okay. Now that you've scratched the itch for those of us who are going to be on public transportation, tell us a little bit about some of the silent film that we'll be seeing this year and some of the orchestras that are going to be scoring the said films.
Right. So this year, we have three films that are celebrating their 100th birthday.
Ooh.
And all three of these films are as modern and wonderful as they were when they were born. But we're starting the festival with Charlie Chaplin's Gold Rush.
Okay.
And that will be accompanied by Timothy Brock. Timothy Brock was hired by the Chaplin estate to renovate, is that what they call it?
Uh-huh.
To work on their scores, the original Charlie Chaplin scores. And so Timothy will be conducting the San Francisco Conservatory of Music Orchestra. And that's a student from the San Francisco Conservatory of Music.
Oh, very cool. Okay. So.
And on closing night, is also 100 years old. It's Buster Keaton's Go West. And Monte Alto Motion Picture Orchestra will be accompanying that. And then on Saturday, Master of the House, which is Carl Dreyer's film. It's from Denmark. It's so beautiful, so funny. And Carl Dreyer was the person who made the masterpiece, The Passion of Joan of Arc.
Mm-hmm.
This is in a completely different wheelhouse. Master of the House is funny. It's feminist. It's pretty great. I really recommend people coming to see Master of the House.
Okay. So I'm actually at the website, which is silentfilm.org. The festival starts on Wednesday, and it opens up with the Charlie Chaplin film that you talked about. But I see a number of films that are somewhat are intriguing to me. So tell me a little bit about The Devil's Circus.
The Devil's Circus. Another Danish crazy director, Benjamin Christensen, who was the person who brought to us Hacksons, Witchcraft Through the Ages. And The Devil's Circus was his first American film.
Mm-hmm.
And it stars Norma Shearer. And it involves a circus.
Mm-hmm.
It involves crime.
Okay.
It has everything going for it, and it has a beautiful score by the Sasha Jacobson Ensemble.
Okay. Now tell me a bit about Saxophone Susie.
Saxophone Susie is a complete delight. Weimar Germany at its frothiest, with Annie Andra. Annie Andra is the woman who was in Hitchcock's Blackmail.
Okay.
Hitchcock's first Hitchcock blonde. It's just a little sassy jazz age wonder. It's very funny, very, very charming.
Okay. And had you had this in the festival before?
Nope.
Oh, okay. So is it?
There are quite a few first timers in the festival, including The Devil's Circus and Saxophone Susie, definitely.
Okay. Now, when I was a kid, I used to see Coco the Clown on TV.
Betty Boop.
Yeah, but it was like out of the inkwell comes Coco the Clown. But so it surprises me that it was a silent animated feature.
Yep.
So talk a little bit about Coco.
Well, Coco was from the wonderful minds of the Fleischers,
mm-hmm.
Max Fleischer,
mm-hmm.
and his brother Dave.
Mm-hmm.
And Coco is Coco was part of a series called Out of the Inkwell, and often had like a live action component to it. You would see Max Fleischer drawing Coco. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of correspondence between the live action drawing mm-hmm. and then the clown. And the clown is a little bit rebellious towards its maker. So a lot of the films involve Coco undermining Max, and Max getting back at Coco.
Go ahead.
They're just brilliant little films. And Wayne Barker, the pianist Wayne Barker, mm-hmm. is going to be joined by sound effects wizard Nicholas White. Mm-hmm. And I really recommend everyone to come see Coco and bring your kids.
Nice. I seem to recall maybe reading that he used his brother-in-law as his model.
He used his brother as his model.
Oh, his brother as his model.
Yeah.
Very cool. Now, let's talk about The Flying Ace, because it's one of those movies where it seems like you don't have that many silent films that have African-American stars.
It's absolutely true. The Flying Ace was... There was a studio in Tallahassee, Florida, all places, mm-hmm. in the 20s that specialized in all-black cast. And The Flying Ace was one, and it's the one that still exists in its entirety. Mm-hmm. And it's about, and in fact, it was the kind of inspired by black airmen, mm-hmm. and inspired by and also inspiring to black pilots. Anyway, it's a little bit of a thriller in which there are two main characters, Lawrence Kleiner and Catherine Boyd. Mm-hmm. And Catherine Boyd holds her own. She's part of the action, and it's, as you know, Marilyn, not many women got to feel their oats in the silent era, but Catherine Boyd does.
Oh, nice. So now talk about Song.
Oh, Song with Anna May Wong. Mm-hmm. So Song is from, again, Weimar, Germany. Anna May Wong left. This is her first film in working with Richard Eichberg, mm-hmm. in Germany. She was a star in Hollywood who wasn't getting any starring roles. So she was in a beautiful film called Toll of the Sea. Mm-hmm. And then after she made like waves with Toll of the Sea, she still couldn't get any roles. She got roles, mm-hmm. but they were stereotypical roles for Asian actors. Mm. And she fed up with this, went to Germany, this is a starring role for Anna May Wong. She's really beautiful. And she had, I also love this. So Anna May Wong went to Germany, and they were hiring people to translate for her. And she said, listen, I'm the only English speaker here. I'll learn German. And she did.
Ah, I like it. I like it a lot.
I know.
So you also have, for the Sherlock Holmes fans, you have something called Silent Sherlock, Three Classic Cases.
Yes. They're like films that were restored by, so short films, three short films restored by the British Film Institute. Mm-hmm. And they're very interesting. Like, it was a Conan Doyle's favorite Sherlock impersonator. Mm. And I never know how to pronounce this guy's name, but it's like, you think of Isle Norwood.
Okay.
Is the Sherlock Holmes guy. And again, it was Conan Doyle's favorite.
Nice. Now, I'm on your website so I can see all the films, but I want to make sure people know it starts this Wednesday. How long does the festival last?
So it starts on Wednesday at 7:30 with mm-hmm. the Gold Rush, and ends on Sunday the 16th with Go West at 7:15. And in between, there are 22 programs altogether. And yeah, and actually something for everyone. And I have to say, and many things, I would recommend everything on this program to everyone. So, but I, you know, you would think that about me.
Mm-hmm.
But I also am just looking at things that where women hold their own.
Mm-hmm.
On Sunday morning, Traylon is a Tom Mix film, which also stars Eva Novak, and it really is just this great Western actioneer,
mm-hmm.
in which there's no side saddle riding a horse for this woman. She's right there. And that also on that day is something I'm pointing out to people, because it's really, we're so lucky to be able to do Song of the Scarlet Flower,
mm-hmm.
which is a film by Moritz Stiller. It was in Swedish with Lars Hansen, mm-hmm. very young role for Lars Hansen. And we got permission from the Swedish Film Institute to use, because it's one of the films that, the only Swedish film actually that had a score that survives to this day. And they gave us permission to adapt the score for ensemble. So composer Gunter Buchwald has made a beautiful adaptation of the original score.
Very good. Very good. So how do people go about finding tickets, and can they walk up and do it?
Yes, they can walk up, but they can also buy tickets online at silentfilm.org. And
Okay.
Silentfilm.org is the place to go for all your ticket and pass information.
Okay.
And schedule.
Okay. Now we're just about out of time, so is there any one thing you want to leave our listening audience with?
Come early, stay late. if you're into comedy, Cole Heisel's Daughter on Sunday early afternoon is so funny. Asphalt is a film from the Weimar that gets down and gritty and speaks to our current political situation. The Affairs of Anatole is a new restoration that the Silent Film Festival had a hand in, as with Beau Geste and the baseball movie, The New Klondike. Also, the world premiere of The Trail of 98, beautiful film. Come see it all. It's really pretty amazing.
All right. Well, with that, Anita Manga, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show, especially to talk about silent film. So thank you. Thank you once again for being on the show.
Thanks, Marilyn. See you in Orinda.
Yeah, you will, actually. All right. People of Earth, this is your opportunity to go check out the Silent Film Festival. Public transportation seems to be pretty easy. It probably takes about as long as it does to just sort of get around the city. So you don't want to miss it. Coming up, we're going to be talking about another film festival. So stay tuned. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. That's a little piano bar by Yoko Kanno and the Seatbelts. We just got through talking about the Silent Film Festival. Now we're going to talk about another film festival that I know you guys are going to be really excited about. Here to talk about some underground films that we all get to see, I'd like to welcome Piranha Psychotronica. Hello.
Hi, Marilyn. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being on the show today. So tell me a little bit about this underground film festival. That what's its actual name, and how did you get involved with it?
Absolutely, yeah. It's the San Francisco Underground Short Film Festival.
Okay.
We're
going
to be doing it at the Four Star Theater in the Outer Richmond district of San Francisco this upcoming Saturday, the 15th.
Okay.
Have you not been to the Four Star?
I've heard of it, but I don't really know where it is.
Yeah, it's on Clement Street, and it's fairly new. I think it was a neighborhood theater for many, many decades back in the past, but then was closed for a long time. And recently, the Cinema SF folks, who also run the Balboa and the Vogue theaters in the Richmond District, acquired and renovated the theater.
Oh.
And it's beautiful, and it's been doing amazing programming. And I'm so happy that we have a great relationship with them. My husband and I have a drag collective called Media Meltdown, and we do a monthly there every Sunday, but this is our first year that we're going to be doing the Film Fest, which we're super thrilled about. It was originally founded in 2003 by Peaches Christ and Vince Santos.
Yeah,
it was back during the Midnight Mass days, and they were making their own short films, these, you know, weirdo underground drag shorts, but nobody was programming them. They tried to submit them to other festivals, and nobody was picking it up. So they were like, you know what, we're going to start our own festival.
I love that.
Yeah, it just, you know, celebrate local filmmakers. And so it continued on at the Bridge Theater until 2008 or so. They don't really remember the dates, so I'm piecing it together.
Okay.
And then around 2011, film programmer Sam Sharkland approached Peaches about reviving the festival. And so they took it over to the Victoria and ran it there for about 4 or 5 years.
Okay.
And so that was right around the same time that I moved to San Francisco from Central California. And I started going to these events, and I got involved with Peaches, and I worked the festival for the last couple years that it was going on. And it was such a cool, wild experience, and it really made me fall in love with San Francisco's arts community, our film community. So many amazing creative people, because it's all films from local directors. So for our, this is 10 years later, since 2015 was when the last time they did at the Victoria. 10 years later, we're bringing it back to its original neighborhood home of the Richmond, and we've got 36 films, all from Bay Area filmmakers, all originated from within the within the nine counties of the Bay Area.
Okay, so is it just one day?
It is, yeah. Because it's a short film festival, some of the films are 1 minute long.
Okay.
Some of them are 25 minutes long, and they vary in between that range. We were accepting anything under 30 minutes.
Okay.
And so, yeah, we've got films ranging from that. But as a result, we've got three programs. So what we're going to be doing is from 5 to 7, there's one, 7:30 to 9:30, and then 10 o'clock to midnight. So you could stay for the entire night. There's going to be live entertainment as well. We've got a couple bands, some drag performers who are going to be joining us. And then, yeah, 36 short films, and they're all so good. We were so thrilled with the submissions we received.
Okay, so clarify this for me. You said you're doing three programs, so it's like a third. Okay,
yeah, each program is about a dozen shorts.
Oh, okay,
I think it varies. Maybe one has 11, one has 13. I don't remember, but and then yeah, one kind of live entertainment act with each. So for the first one at 5 o'clock, where you have Oakland-based band Mommy, we're going to be joining us, and then for 7:30, it's local San Francisco-based hip-hop musician, producer Dolly.
Okay.
And then closing things out is one of my favorite local drag performers, Louise Me Munster.
Okay.
And Kafka X and myself will be hosting, and I'm sure we'll perform at some point too, but we got to figure that out still.
Excellent, excellent. Now, so have you had the opportunity to see any of the films in advance?
Yeah, so we were helping programming all of them. We had a couple people who were watching all the films and helping us limit down. We had over 300 submissions.
Wow.
Yeah. And we only had a few rules. So there was, you know, we were able to eliminate a couple just off the bat because, oh, you didn't actually, you're not from the Bay Area. Or your film is a little too long or it's a little too old. We were only really looking for things from within the last 5 years. Just to limit it down a little bit. And out of that, you know, 300 submissions, and we limited it down to the 35, 36 that I mentioned. And I was so thrilled because we kind of had to come up with a tier system of how we're, you know, this one we really like, this one we're maybe a little unsure
of. Oh, okay, I got you.
And, but everything that ended up in the festival was on our highest tier. And in fact, we had to trim some of those just for time. So what's left over is really like an amazing and diverse selection of different films. A lot of them are narrative shorts, but there's some experimental music videos, animation, documentary. And it really is like such a beautiful snapshot of like the Bay Area art scene, I would say.
So people who are making short films now, I know in the past people use like, you know, what is it? 16 millimeter and blah, 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 blah. Nowadays, are people submitting you movies that they've done on their phones or like what, how are people making films, these short films now?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I'd have to talk to the filmmakers more. A lot of them didn't provide that information necessarily, but for sure, I think most of the films are shot on some kind of digital camera.
Oh, okay.
But that's not true across the board. We have a couple films in the short, the festival that are 16 millimeter, a couple that were shot on 35 millimeter. You know, potentially other film methods, but you know, out of the ones that we know how they were shot, there's definitely a handful.
Okay. Now you said you've seen a lot of the films. You haven't necessarily seen all of them, but you've seen
every single one.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Was in that 35, 36 films, what do you remember, which was the first one that you saw that you were like, oh my gosh, we have to include this?
Oh yeah, interesting. Well, I'll tell you, the very first submission that we got was a film called Narthex, which is a director by, the director's name is Max Rock. And it was submitted on Film Freeway, which is a, you know, a site used by film festivals to collect submissions like this.
Oh.
And
what's that site again?
Film Freeway.
Okay.
So yeah, if you're a local filmmaker or a filmmaker anywhere, Film Freeway is a great resource to find festivals. Yeah,
okay.
And then submit, or for me, for a festival to then receive those submissions. And I noticed this person's right around the corner from us.
Oh.
Turns out one of our next door neighbors, pretty much. I was like, oh, it was shot in the neighborhood. I was like, oh, I know that spot. I know that spot. And that was the very first submission we received. Now, we didn't end up watching that one until later. But as soon as we saw it, we were like, oh, this is actually also really good. And we're excited to be able to include it in the fest.
I got
to
say, whenever I'm watching a TV show or a movie and they're in San Francisco, I'm like, I know where that is. I know where that is. And I get excited when it's actually geographically accurate, as opposed to, you know, and but I also find it amusing when it's wildly inaccurate. Like, they like, there's a episode of Streets of San Francisco where they're in Dolores Park, and then they flip the camera around and you can see Alcatraz.
Right.
You know, I love those kinds of, I don't know if they'd be called anachronisms, but, you know, just that, those sort of wild flights of fancy geographically.
It's so funny. I was watching a movie from the 80s, I think, called Neon Demons. No, that's not right. Neon Maniacs.
Okay.
It's like a silly 80s monster movie, but it's set here in the Bay Area. It's so obvious that they shot most of it in L.A. or somewhere else, because it's like, nowhere does that house exist.
Exactly, exactly.
Who has that much yard space?
Yeah. I once saw, I was watching, I guess it was Dharma and Greg, and it's supposed to be in the Muni, and I'm like, that is the New York subway. Nothing looks like this. So.
Absolutely, I loved that show when I was growing up. So funny.
But I digress. Let's talk more about the film festival. So, what are some of the films that you find the most entertaining that are going to be part of this year's lineup?
Oh, that's a great question. There's so many. I'll tell you, some of the ones that stand out to me the most are the longer films, just because they, you know, I think everything is great, and it's so hard. It's like choosing one of your favorite children.
Right.
But the some of the ones that I think about most readily are a film called Fancy Phone Numbers, which was directed by local drag performer C. Quinette.
Okay.
And it's a retelling of Salome's Last Dance.
Ooh.
That was set, they filmed it at the Madonna Inn.
Okay.
Seemingly over quarantine because nobody's there. Otherwise, they just had amazing luck finding times when nobody was in these zones. And I'm pretty sure that was one that was shot on film.
Okay.
I don't remember what what size. But and then there's this amazing film called Smooth. This is on the entire opposite end of the spectrum by a filmmaker named Seppi Mashiahoff. I might be butchering her last name. And that's more of like a body horror short film about a trans woman who has a lot of dysphoria around her body hair and continues to shave and shave and shave until you can fill in the dots.
I can fill in the dots for sure. What's one? What's your shortest film?
It's a film called Woe, and I'm going to forget the director's name. It's Christian Enzensivor. I don't think that's right. It's a very simple film. It's only one actor, one room, but it's got such a funny little twist at the end. And we really wanted to include that one because, you know, it doesn't do anything wildly technical or anything, but it really demonstrates that you can make an effective film with no money. You know, this film, it's probably, I'm assuming, the director who is the one actor, and it's such a simple little twist of the story, completely nonverbal, but it's so effective, and I'm excited for people to see that one.
I'm also excited to hear that you can submit 1 minute movies, because I'm sure there are a lot of people out there who have an idea, but their ideas, it's you know, contained, and it's very, you would think, oh, well, if it's under 80 minutes, no one's going to want to see it or show it, but your festival allows for these real short form videos.
Yeah, and in fact, really celebrates them, I would say. In fact, it's way easier to program a 1 minute film than a 30-minute film.
Why?
Well, if you have a 90-minute program to fill, you can include 90 1 minute shorts.
Right.
Only three of the 30-minute ones. And so we did get a couple longer films that were like, this is really compelling, but it's 20 minutes long. It was really compelling for the first 3 minutes.
Oh.
And then it's a really, and it just keeps going and going. And I would say if you have limited means or just one really tight idea, by all means make that, because there are a lot of short film festivals, not only ours, we will be continuing this in future years, but they're all over the place. And anybody can make a film these days. We all have cameras in our pockets. And it's that kind of spirit of just making art for art's sake that we really wanted to, that's why we wanted to do this festival. It's such a, I think, a nice thing right now is things are very dark politically, very weird politically, to just inspire people to go out and with community make art and celebrate art and get involved more in local entertainment and investing. And, you know, I could go on, but
And you mentioned earlier that there were a number of them, like basically you chose all the gold, and even among the gold, you still had to like let go of some.
Yeah.
So when you let go of the gold, do you reach out to those people who've made the films and go, it was only a lack of time that, so please submit again, or what?
100%. Yeah, I sent an email to everyone who submitted and basically explained just that. We really enjoyed being able to review everyone's submissions, and there were so many great options. And so please don't take this as a discouragement. You know,
right.
I also make films. I submit to film festivals. Sometimes you don't get in, and there's a variety of reasons, but it truly wasn't for lack of quality this time around.
Okay. So once more for our listening audience, when and where and how do you get tickets?
Absolutely. So it's this Saturday, November 15th at the Four Star Theater in the Outer Richmond District of San Francisco.
Okay.
You can add to the Four Stars website, which is 4-star-movies.com, or probably more easily our website, which is MediaMeltdown.tv.
MediaMeltdown.tv. Yeah. All right. Well, Piranha, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
People of Earth, you know how we San Franciscans love our movies, and you could see 30-something films, 35 films in one day. And then you could tell all your friends and you get earned bragging rights. So I've got yet another interview that's going to fascinate you and knock your socks off. So please, please stay tuned. I'm begging you. You're listening to 89.5 FM, KPOO, San Francisco. Coming up next for you, I'd like to welcome a guest who has a show with a title that I can thoroughly relate to. It's called Before I Forget. Here to talk about that, I'd like to welcome Adam Strauss. Hello.
Hello. Yeah, thanks for having me, Marilyn.
Thank you for being on the show today. So, Adam, tell me a little bit about Before I Forget.
Yeah, so this is a solo show at the Marsh Theater, and in a sense, it's a sort of up-to-the-minute sequel of my last solo show, which had its West Coast premiere at the Marsh, which was called The Mushroom Cure. That was the true story of treating my, at that time, very debilitating obsessive-compulsive disorder with psychedelics.
Mm-hmm.
And this show picks up where that show left off, which, without spoiling too much for people who haven't seen that show, I wouldn't say I'm cured, but the OCD is dramatically better. But, you know, life goes on and I'm getting older. Of mm-hmm. course, the one certainty, time waits for no one.
Mm-hmm.
And so the issues this show delves into are, there's a range of them, but Alzheimer's is a big part of the show, which is something that unfortunately my father is suffering from. And mm-hmm. of course, when one member of the family suffers from Alzheimer's, it really affects everyone, and also mm-hmm. calls into question or brings up for me my own risk, because this is largely genetic. So that's one sort of thread or through line of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Another is, so that's sort of one end of the spectrum. The show also deals with artificial intelligence in a way that, to my knowledge, is pretty unique in theater. And I don't want to spoil too much there, but I will say, sort of ironically, it actually deepens the humanity of the show. So if I had to sum it up in a few words, I would say this show is really about the passage of time and the confrontation with mortality and meaning that I think everyone ultimately grapples with, regardless of their specific life circumstances and regardless of whether they're dealing with dementia or not.
Okay, so let's talk about, you said this is the sequel to The Mushroom Cure. I know from the past that people would come up to you and talk to you about that show. have people talk to you about the themes that you've covered in this show?
Yeah, so, and I should say, this is the world premiere, so I've done work-in-progress versions of this show.
Mm-hmm.
In the Marsh in Berkeley, we did a brief run of three or four shows in late spring this year, and then I've done it in New York, but there haven't been many performances. So one of the things I'm sort of curious about is, of course, how does this resonate? Because to me, there's the onstage experience, which is paramount. This is entertainment. I want to touch people. I want to move people. And of course, I want to make people laugh.
Mm-hmm.
But because this is an autobiographical solo show, as you just alluded to, sort of part of it is it's always very revealing to me what people share when they come up after the show. And with the Mushroom Cure, the big revelation for me was so many people would come up and say, hey, I don't have OCD, but hearing you talk so openly and directly about your own experience with this particular form of quite debilitating mental illness makes me feel less alone with my fill in the blank depression,
mm-hmm.
eating disorder, or just the general and inevitable suffering that every human has to contend with as part of being alive. So I'm curious, as we do this show more, will there be something similar where people maybe they don't, have Alzheimer's or know someone with Alzheimer's, but maybe mm-hmm. that resonates at a deeper level? Or the artificial intelligence angle is clearly something that is, especially in the Bay Area, I think top of mind for so many people. So yeah, it's hard to tell without doing the show what is really gonna hook people in. But I think there's a number of angles that that most people will be able to relate to at least one of them.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that you have an unusual co-star, which is ChatGPT. When you were developing this show, at the beginning, it was like, ChatGPTs will solve everything, will replace everybody. And then the darker side of ChatGPT started to be revealed in terms of, people getting sort of ChatGPT psychosis and people committing suicide. So did those revelations also shape the show, or was it sort of baked in? Was it already a fixed product before the darkness came out?
No. Well, so I have two things to say. First of all, I would say, ChatGPT and AI, it is a part of this show, but mm-hmm. the vast majority of the show is just me on stage alone. But we do have an absolutely pivotal scene that involves ChatGPT, and it's not baked in. It's actually, it takes place without kind of revealing too much. These are actual conversations with ChatGPT.
Okay. Okay.
And this grew out of my own experience, because this is an autobiographical show, and because it is sort of the up to the minute of where my life is at right now,
mm-hmm.
as I was contending with the challenges that I recount in this show, and recount isn't even quite the right word because I'm still going through them, of my father's Alzheimer's, of relationship challenges, OCD, mm-hmm. psychedelics, mm-hmm. all this stuff that, is part of my life. I started talking to ChatGPT about this, mm-hmm. which, of course, is an experience that more and more people are having.
Mm-hmm.
So the show is not sort of a pro-AI show or an anti-AI show. This is just capturing I guess one way to look at it is I have a relationship with my father. I have a relationship, I have romantic relationships. I have a relationship, in a sense, with mushrooms. And I have a relationship with ChatGPT. The cool thing about ChatGPT is I'm not bringing my father on stage.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not taking mushrooms on stage, as tempting as that might be. But I can actually pop open a laptop, as indeed I do, and bring ChatGPT on stage with me. And so that opportunity, really, my director, Jonathan Libman, identified it as I was kind of just, because we're friends and we're working together, and I'm telling him about this stuff, and he's like, I think we should try to bring this on stage.
Okay.
So suffice to say that, yeah, I see AI, particularly in the context of sort of therapy or analyzing one's life, as a double-edged sword, where it absolutely can be helpful, but there is a dark side. And sort of apart from the show, I do feel like the dangers probably outweigh the benefits.
Mm.
both short-term and long-term, and both at the individual level and the societal level. Having said that, it is something that is here, and it is something I use in my regular life, and I do find it helpful in some contexts, and so that's really what brought it onto the stage.
Okay. How long ago was your father diagnosed with Alzheimer's?
So he was officially diagnosed, I believe it was 2019, and as I think a lot of people who have experience with this disease can relate to, the diagnosis is often, it's shocking in a way, but it's also like not that surprising because there's early signs that, you know, often bring someone in to get diagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that was the official diagnosis, I guess, around 6 years ago.
So what were some of the early signs? And when you saw these signs, did they make sense at the time? Like, were you suspicious, or was it that there was the diagnosis and then you went, aha, well, that explains this, this, and this?
Yeah, it's a good question, because I think the signs were classic signs of, you know, it wasn't like he was forgetting my name, but he was forgetting relatively recent events. And I'd say the biggest thing, if I'm thinking back like 6 years ago,
mm-hmm.
was repeating himself. Repeating questions, repeating stories in the course of, you know, a 5 minute time frame.
Mm.
And so on one level, you're like, well, something is going on here. But at the other, on another level, there's this real, I think, very human desire to kind of minimize it or dismiss it.
Sure.
To be like, oh, he's tired, or he was working a long day yesterday,
mm-hmm.
or he hasn't had breakfast yet, his blood sugar is low. So it's sort of this creeping dread that something is going on. And of mm-hmm. course, when someone is at that point, he was in his late 60s,
mm-hmm.
when someone at that age is having memory issues, I think anyone is going to probably flash to the possibility of Alzheimer's or other dementias.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there's like, well, it could be this, it could be that, it could be...
Sure.
So, so when the diagnosis came, it, as I said, it was not a surprise, but, you know, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It's heartbreaking.
Right.
It's heartbreaking when you realize, like, not only is this a temporary sort of situation that has a specific cause that's going to resolve, but also this is pretty much certainly going to get worse.
Right. So this may seem like an odd question, but in observing the Alzheimer's, do you see any parallels with the Alzheimer's and your own obsessive compulsive disorder? Does being obsessive compulsive help in any way with dealing with an Alzheimer's patient?
You know, it's interesting because for some people, like when I talk about having OCD, people who haven't seen my shows or don't know me often think, oh, this guy must be super organized.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, excuse me, that is not the case. And in fact, many people with OCD tend towards the other extreme of being chaotic. And I am on that end of the spectrum. So I can imagine someone who is super organized, it might actually mitigate some of the effects of dementia for themselves if they were to come down with it because, uh-huh. you know, hey, you know exactly where your car keys are. You know mm-hmm. exactly where to find your car title. It's filed away.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of future risks for me, unfortunately, it won't be helpful. But in terms of my current reality,
mm-hmm.
so one of the things the show grapples with is I think a lot of people feel like, well, you're going to get it or you're not going to get it, but there's specific, you can fairly accurately assess your risk at this point.
Really?
Based on quite a large number of tests, including genetic testing.
Mm-hmm.
And so suffice to say, my father has a genotype that essentially guarantees he would get Alzheimer's. We didn't know this until
wow.
he was diagnosed. And that increases my risk of having the same genotype. And so, to be honest,
mm-hmm.
this can feed into my obsessive nature where I can obsess about this. And that's part of what the show deals with is the obsessive anxiety. And the big question is, do you want to know if you're very likely to get Alzheimer's? Because when I saw a neurologist, they were like, hey, you could do this test and it'll be pretty highly predictive if you, depending on the results. But she said, if I were you, I wouldn't get the test. I wouldn't want to know. And that's what a lot of people think. And then the flip side is, well, maybe you do want to know so you can kind of plan and you know how much time you have left. So that is a big part of the show, is me grappling with that question. Do I actually want to know if, you know, how likely is it that I'm going to unfortunately follow in my father's cognitive footsteps?
Mm. Now that there's been a diagnosis of Alzheimer's in the family, do you follow the Alzheimer's research more closely, and is there anything that seems to be promising? Because they say Alzheimer's is a form of dementia where plaques build up, and maybe if you there might be some therapies. Do you know that?
Yeah, I do follow it closely, less for myself than for my father, because
sure.
Of course I'd say that's the second stage in most, you know, most diagnoses when there's a chronic incurable condition is, okay, what can we do to mitigate this?
Mm-hmm.
And so I've become quite active. And actually, this is another way I use ChatGPT, is to keep me abreast of the research. And yeah, there's promising. It's sort of, on one hand, I want to say there's a lot of promising research happening. On the other hand, I'd be remiss if I didn't say there's been a lot of promising research happening for decades, and there has not been any breakthroughs. So there's therapies and a couple that were FDA approved recently that reduce amyloid plaques, which is thought to be part of the main mechanism for Alzheimer's, but they don't really have a big effect on symptoms. And there's this question of the tau protein. And so there's therapies that may reduce that that haven't been approved yet. So the bottom line is, right now, there are therapies that improve the outcome somewhat if you're early stage, but there's no real breakthroughs. But there is promising stuff that could be breakthroughs. But again, there's been promising stuff that's been hailed as breakthroughs in the past, and it hasn't lived up to its promise. I mean, this is, in terms of very common diseases, if you look at, like, you know, heart disease, there's been huge strides made. Cancer, there's been huge strides made. But this, there really have not been. So I'm hopeful that is going to change, and in hopefully not too long a time frame. And that's something that could, you know, have an impact for me and my siblings, who obviously also are at high risk. I think the odds at this point of something happening that would really make an impact for my father are low. But I will say one thing: there have been some studies in mice that have showed certain interventions not only halt the progression, but can reverse the disease.
Oh.
So, I mean, you know, you don't want to hope too much,
right,
of course.
Right.
And I don't hope too much, but it's not theoretically impossible that, like, when I think about that, my father getting some therapy and suddenly returning to who he was, I mean, it's too good to be true and too good to imagine, but it's not entirely in the realm of science fiction, but probably unlikely.
Okay. Well, for our listening audience, when and where for Before I Forget?
That, fortunately, I do remember. It is. So we're playing at the Marsh Theater. We have previews this Thursday and Friday. Official opening night is this Saturday, November 15th. And then the show runs every Friday and Saturday through December 13th, with the exception of the last weekend in Thanksgiving, right after last weekend in November, right after Thanksgiving, when I'll be home on the East Coast, celebrating with my father and the rest of the family.
Okay.
And so, that is at the Marsh on Valencia Street.
On Valencia Street. Excellent. How do people go about getting tickets?
Yeah, you can go to the Marsh website, themarsh.org, or if you find me on social media or my website, that's all linked to the Marsh, to ticket sales platforms.
All right. Well, Adam Strauss, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today and for talking about this topic that, as we get older, is more and more in our radar. So I appreciate you.
Yeah,
and
thanks for having me.
Thank you. Okay, people of Earth, this is your opportunity. It is Before I Forget at the Marsh, and that's happening. He gave all the information. Mr. Ford is here to pleasure your ear hole. I'm going to leave you with a little bit of Bjork. I'll see you next week. Until then, ta-ta and toodly-doo.